So, today, Easter Sunday afternoon, 2011, we're going to play a game, in a sense. We are going to sit with some questions. We might find glimmerings of answers. And we might also individually and collectively reflect on what we think a question is and what we think an answer is. This is really central to our processes of self-inquiry, because our processes of self-inquiry depend on what we think knowledge is and whether we think that asking questions and listening to answers deepens our knowledge of who we are and who the other is, and whether there is any distinction between self and other. So the questions that you have chosen to put into the little bowl today, the answers that I will find in myself today, which might be different from the answers that I would find in myself yesterday or tomorrow, they are part of informing us more broadly about what we think a question is, how we bring a question to our consciousness, and what we think an answer is, and how we embody a so-called answer in our life, in who we are becoming. One of the questions you've been reflecting on in your personal reflection time is, who am I becoming? The question could have been asked, what am I becoming? Or, what am I using in my becoming? Which strengths, which virtues, which guidances, which teachings am I using in my becoming? We can't halt our becoming because we are living creatures and dynamic. We can't halt our becoming. The question is, and this is a question, what is the nature of my becoming? How conscious is my becoming? And really, how useful, not in the sense of utility, but how engaged, how fruitful is my becoming? And I'm not meaning fruitful in a big sense. I'm just meaning, how am I affecting others in my most ordinary encounters? In my becoming, I am affecting others. So that takes us to another question, doesn't it? How am I affecting others through my becoming, through my being, through my wishing, through my desiring, through my trusting in the sacredness of my own life? The degree to which we trust the sacredness of our own life will so strongly determine who we are becoming and how others can receive us and how we can receive them in that constant dance that I have referred to of giving and receiving. How lovely to know we're not alone in this. So thank you so much to all of those of you who did find a question in your hearts and find a way to put it into the bowl. Thank you so much. And I'll do my very best. When we think of all beings as sacred, Please talk a little of how we accept our teenagers, who we view as sacred, indulging in and bringing in material that we see as not sacred and harmful. For example, violent games, aggressive music, less than sacred behavior towards us and each other. It's not only the teenagers. If it was only the teenagers, we would have really no problem. It is their job as teenagers to separate from us. How do we keep our homes sacred and our love and integrity without imposing ourselves on them? How much of our home is ours to claim as sacred, and how much is theirs? All right, well, this is a wonderful question, because the sacred does not divide from the so-called profane. We bring a sacred view to all behaviors, including those that are unwelcome. We don't separate ourselves from them. This has been one of the great failings of the institutional religions, that they have wanted to divide which can't be divided. Human behavior manifests in different ways. Some of them welcome, some of them grossly unwelcome and disastrous. Disastrous. Let's not, hesitate to call what it is. Some of those behaviors are disastrous. But when we stand in a sacred corner and exile those behaviors to a profane corner, we can never heal them nor their reflections in ourselves. We are disturbed by what is aggressive and violent out there, not because it is entirely foreign to us, but because it is not entirely foreign to us. With our teenagers and with our children and with our everybody, the very best that we can do is to model, not to preach, is to model that this is unwelcome, unfruitful, barren, unrewarding. But not to preach. We can say the effect that it has on us. I think we're entitled to do that. I think we're entitled to say, I feel really jangled when I hear this music. Or I have to say, I find the images and the kind of ideology of those games really offensive. They affect the energy of this house, and therefore they affect me. I think it's very fine to say that, particularly to teenagers who are more than able to comprehend this. But the forbidding, the absolute banning, the expressions of disgust are really divisive. I think in regard to children and teenagers too, that sometimes we are not creative enough in making situations attractive where other kinds of things are explored. You know, we can say to ourselves we're too exhausted to have certain kinds of discussions, or we're too exhausted to engage in ways that are maybe even rather challenging to us. So we can think about that too. What are we offering as an alternative? That was a very rich question. Thank you for asking it. And my answer is very partial. Very incomplete. But maybe the part of the answer that matters is to really think about two things. One is the inclusiveness of the sacred view, and the other is, how can I myself be more creative in my interactions with others, more alive, more enchanting, more entrancing, even when I'm exhausted? And of course, none of us really has to be that all of the time. No one wants that from us all of the time. But I think our children want it from us some of the time. And our teenagers. And our friends. And our partners. And our lovers. They want that from us some of the time.
I think somebody's given me a little quote from Seeking the Sacred here. When a religious teaching leaves out love, it ceases to be religion. Religious. Where a spiritual teaching sentimentalizes love, it ceases to be spiritual. Could you explain further, please? Well, yes, I could. But I think I need to explain this very little, because in fact we know this, that when a religious teaching justifies violence, justifies divisiveness, bows down at the altar of power, or sexism, or racism, or cultural or religious superiority, it leaves out love. And in my humble view, it ceases to be religious. It becomes an institution of power. That doesn't mean that the religion ceases to be religious overall, because as I said yesterday, and I think also the day before, all of our religions, all of the institutions that we call religious, grew out of the wisdom stream. Where else could they have come from? They all have at their hearts profound teachings on love. I sometimes think, and I'm sure I wrote this in Seeking the Sacred too, what a miracle that so much has survived, given our big appetite for power, superiority, aggression, divisiveness. Our religions are human institutions. They have the same weaknesses that we do, multiplied by whatever. I'm not a mathematician. Maybe one of you is a mathematician, and you can tell me how many times the individual is multiplied in an institution. So the good is multiplied, and so is the bad. The weaknesses are multiplied and called strengths. So we have to have a lot of tenderness also towards our religious institutions. I think so. I think that's helpful. We need to soften them. And we can't soften them by hardening our hearts against them. They've also preserved teachings for us. At the same time, we can be very clear about what is not religious. I think we are entitled to that. And also, for the first time in human history, women have a voice to say that. Lay people have voices to say that. The disenfranchised are now more enfranchised, are they not? Bravo, I say. Where a spiritual teaching sentimentalizes love, it ceases to be spiritual, yes. There's a lot of sentimentality in so-called spirituality. It's particularly when someone would make the claim, for example, you know, I'm a deeply spiritual person, but I don't actually care much about other people. I do a lot of meditation, and I have a very big collection of crystals. Where is my social work? I mean, where is my care? Now, I must immediately say this. I'm being rather frivolous here. I must immediately say that I have the deepest respect for contemplative orders who are not out in the world, who do their work for the world, from a place of contemplation. I am not in any way trivializing that. If I have any belief in rebirth, and I have a bit of a belief in it, I feel I've had many lives in contemplative orders. I find it so attractive. I'm not speaking about that. I'm speaking about a spirituality that is not confronting of our behaviors towards other people, that doesn't ask us constantly to look at our conduct, because that is really where our spiritual life is developed. Our spiritual practice is developed through our conduct with others, and particularly with those particular others who refuse to see life quite as we'd like them to. Thank you for that question. We're all subject to all of it. We're all subject to our fundamentalist moments. We're all subject to our very sentimental, self-congratulatory moments. I say this not looking at others. When I think of religious institutions and fun, I look also alongside. I know those weaknesses very well because I know those weaknesses. But the teachings on religion, the teachings on love in the religions, actually require something of us. I think in Forgiveness and Other Acts of Love, I quoted Stephen Covey, who's a Mormon and who wrote a book called The Seven Habits of Highly Successful People. And one of the things that he said that really struck me was, you may be good, but what are you good for? And his wife, who had, I think, 10 children, wrote The Seven Habits of Highly Successful Families with her husband and said, if anyone says one more child doesn't make a difference, they haven't had one more child. You know, we have to be practical. One of the great things about this moment, this historical moment, is that our wading in the stream of wisdom, our diving into the oceans of mysticism, requires of us that we emerge with a clearer ethic and not a weakened one. Our mysticism today is highly ethical. And when anybody says to me as an interfaith minister, are you not picking and choosing? I say, yes, I am picking and choosing. I am picking what will support me in my development, and I am choosing as best I can to express it. I hope you're also picking and choosing, picking the teachings that will support you to become the perfection that you are, and not to be frightened of it. Picking the teachings that will develop your good humor, your earthiness, your tolerance, your courage to get up when you've fallen flat on your face. That's what you need. That's what we all need. It's when we are frightened to make a mistake that we become hysterical about other people's mistakes. Isn't it true? Or gloat at other people's mistakes and suffering. When we can just take it as part of the human condition, we are also so much more likely to take our own mistakes as part of our natural evolution. To be unafraid to make a mistake is very freeing. To know that you are who you are, mistakes, not mistakes, today, tomorrow, you are who you are. Honours, plaudits, what's it called when you get in a job and you...
Promotions.
Promotions. Demotions. Sack. Not the sack. Come here. Don't come here. You are who you are. In all of that, tide comes in, tide goes out. Still the ocean. Still the ocean. Oh, that's hard for us to learn, isn't it? It's hard for us to learn. We cling to the reassurances from the outside instead of as well as growing the reassurances from the inside. All right. Can you talk to us more about receiving more openly support from someone who really wants to support you, but they're not giving you that support in the way you want it? Or it doesn't have a lot of space around it. This is a very tricky question, isn't it? It's a very tricky question because I might not even be able to answer it in the way you really want it. I might not even be able to answer it with enough spaciousness around it. I suspect that this question really comes from a bigger question, which is about our boundaries. Which is about boundaries. And this is always something that is being constantly negotiated in all of our connections that matter. And of course, it's hardest to negotiate in our connections that most erupt our youngest self, or where we feel least able to assert ourselves good-humouredly and kindly. So, for example, if someone is offering you support and it doesn't feel like the right way, it is, on the one hand, possible simply to say, "Thank you, that is such a good idea, I'll really think about it." It's also possible to experience it as someone trying to make you into a person that you are not entirely, as perhaps happened, you know, when you were 8 or 18 or 28 or 78. Or it may be that in trying to support you, the person is actually trying to rewrite your agenda. So it really depends on the nature of what this bouquet of flowers is. How many thorns are in the roses? Whether you can put this bouquet into a vase and give it some life, or whether it is too uncomfortable even to pick up and put into a vase. So I would suggest that when we have a lot of difficulty with how One person is trying to give us support. We think about support more generally. We think about our attitude to support more generally. We think about encroachments on our boundaries more generally. And that will give us a greater understanding, not of that other person and their support or advice or agenda, but of our reception of it. And in some situations, if you have a reasonably psychologically sophisticated relationship with that person, at some time you can tell them what's happening for you as they offer you support without in any way making them wrong. You can add to their knowledge of you by saying, you know, I'm just so surprised to discover that I feel hemmed in rather than supported. Or, I really wish it were not the case, but I feel diminished rather than encouraged. And I've been thinking about this for a few months, and I realize that in my family, encouragement was very rarely given explicitly. It was usually given through orders. Do this, underlying, you're capable of doing it, but not ever said, you know, this is something you're really good at, Sylvia. Why don't you take this on? Yeah. So in thinking about your reception, you grow in self-knowledge. In thinking of your reception, you create the space around it. In thinking of reception, there is at least some possibility that you can more generously inform the other person of what's going on with you. And be maybe a little less reactive. It's in these boundary situations that we are most reactive and least considered. I really hope that was helpful, because I think everyone in this room would like to have asked that question. Really. And I've talked a lot about receiving, haven't I, over this time? Because quite a lot of people who come on retreat are more habituated towards, more practiced in giving, sometimes so much easier than receiving, partly because of the inherent disappointments in receiving. But it's not all disappointments. The rose is there too, as well as the thorn. Someone wants me to give the references for the Deuteronomy Choose Life quote and the Corinthians, the Temple of the Heart. The references are in Seeking the Sacred. I don't have them right in my head at this very moment, but they're in Seeking the Sacred. What does it look like to be spiritually ambitious? What would be the goals of one who is spiritually ambitious? That's entirely for you to decide. Spiritually ambitious, how it would look for me might be completely different. All I'm saying is step up to the mark, you know. Find a huge mark and step up to it. Don't be timid. Don't regard yourself as Well, disenfranchised was a word I used a few minutes ago. You are enfranchised. There is no reason why you shouldn't step up, claim the great teachings, make them yours. Make them yours. You're not too small for them. you know, they might fit. It's sometimes we can step into a false humility that we're not ready to take on the challenge of at least the silver rule. Do no harm. What would it mean, really, to take on harm stops with me? You know, you have to be quite ambitious, don't you think, to take that on?
Ambitious or courageous?
Ambitious and courageous. Do you remember in Forgiveness and Other Acts of Love that I started with courage? Because every change of mind, every transformation of view, every new day, a new beginning, starts with courage. Never mind the golden rule. How do you actually make a choice? What an interesting question. She doesn't mean, I think, how do I make a choice? She means, how does she, in this case I happen to know it's a she, how does she make a choice? So this is a question she can live with for many years, and so can you. She has given you a wonderful question. How do I make a choice? And even better, how do I live the choices that I make? How do I make a choice? Well, there's all sorts of ways, and you don't really need me to review them. But consciousness plays a part. Consciousness and conscience play their part. They are the unique gifts of our species that we can learn from the past and anticipate the future in the present moment. Can't we? Sometimes we need to remember what we know in order to make a choice. We need to remember what we know. And one of the very, very profound reasons for coming on retreat, going to our services, reading the great scriptures, reading the great teachings, is to remember what we know. And at a very practical level, I want to urge you to the spiritual practice of journal writing. Writing down your question, writing down your answer. I'm sure there is not a person in this room who didn't discover something surprising to himself or herself when you wrote your questions, wrote your answers in these last days, rather than simply ruminating. Ruminating often means that we are turning over and over the same thoughts without moving in a fresh direction. When we write something down, and let's call it in our journal, in our notebook, yeah, because that's a lovely way of honouring our processes, when we write something down, we give ourselves at least a chance to discover something fresh. We give ourselves that wonderful chance. My whole writing life has been about this. Discovering, synthesizing, remembering, re-remembering, learning something new in the outside world through experience as well as through reading. Reading my experiences through my writing, through my journal writing, through my professional writing. Reading your experiences. Even if you're not a big reader, many, many people in spiritual life are not big readers. It's not required. But writing things down is part of your transformation, supports your transformation, gives a gift from yourself to yourself. Because it also puts you in touch with the wisdom that you already have. And that's so easily forgotten. A light, well-timed, appropriate sense of humor comes so well and seemingly easy to some. How can I tap into this powerful and lovely resource? What a beautiful question. Yes, I will say it again. This person enjoys a light, well-timed, appropriate sense of humor and wants more of it. And I would say that any quality that we want more of, we get more of through our appreciation of it, our exposure to it. We hang around with people who are like that. And we enjoy them. And we appreciate it. You know, we spend very little time with scolding grumpies. Yeah, we spend as little time as is decent. Actually, we spend a little less time than is decent. And we spend more time in the company of people who lift our spirits. I think that's what's being asked here. We spend time in the company of people who lift our spirits, and we become such a person ourselves. We take on the responsibility of being someone who lifts other people's spirits, not through our preaching and good works, simply through our acceptance. Through our acceptance, I think. When I work with so many women over the course of a year, and last year and this year again, it's mainly women in rural areas of Australia who've all had breast cancer, and they come sometimes with support people, sometimes without. This is the work that I do with Breast Cancer Network Australia. And I always find a way to say this, that when we've had the wake-up call, the meditation bell, that mortality, alas, does apply to us also. I feel really sad as I say this because it's so hard for us to learn. That it's actually a fine thing to spend more and more time in the company of people who lift your spirits and less time in the company of those who, for one tragedy or another, are committed to a bitter view of life. We can't actually afford to cultivate a bitter view of life. Or an embittered view of life. Nor can we be that person in the company of our own mind. We can't afford it. Whether we have we have some people in this room who are very young, whether we have another 70 or 80 years, Pieta, we can't afford to waste a minute on bitterness. So when bitterness arises in our hearts, we really need to bring our best compassion to it, our softest heart to that bitterness, and really understand it and let it go. And really understand it and let it go. Tell it what a good job it's done, but its job is over. And transform it. inside that bitterness is always grief. And maybe we can let it go. When I acknowledge in the moment procrastination dies, what I confront with love alone ceases to disturb me. I think this isn't a question, it's a sharing. I'll share the last one particularly. When I confront with love, when I meet something with love alone, it ceases to disturb me. How beautiful. And this person has made the signs of Om. So sometimes we can meet what disturbs us with the sound of Om. And sometimes we need to meet what disturbs us. Maybe it's disturbed us for a very good reason. Maybe we need to meet it, shake its hand and sit down like a grown-up person and meet it. And meet it as an equal. You have disturbed me. Maybe I needed disturbing. Maybe I was a little bit taking things for granted here. Maybe I need a new question. Maybe I need to live into a question at a new level of consciousness. Very good. Questions. What are your thoughts and views on eating meat? You know what? My thoughts and views are irrelevant. What are your thoughts and views on eating meat? Please take into account your thoughts and views on eating meat and why you chose to put this question into the bowl. What does this question mean for you? When you feel consistently angry with someone or some situation, how do you manage the grace of forgiveness? Someone always asks me a question rather like this. And I always have to say that any answer I can give in a teaching session like this will be very partial, very much a small part of an answer only, because forgiveness is perhaps the most challenging of the sacred qualities. And if it is a big matter, and I assume it's a big matter that this person has put in our bowl, we will come to it bit by bit. So I would really ask you to read Forgiveness and Other Acts of Love, where I had several years to refine my thoughts. So I'm just going to say a couple of things now. One is that when a big act of forgiveness seems to be needed, we need to come into it in our own time and pace. We don't do it because we're afraid that if we don't do it, we won't go to heaven. Or that if we don't do it, we're not the good person we would like to be. So we assume that our difficulties with it are themselves a profound teacher. We might also notice that there are stages to forgiveness. Many people have talked about this, and I write about it also. But one of the absolutely key things, and it can soften the anger that is harming you much more than it is harming the other person, in the same way that you forgive eventually for your sake and not just for the other person. One of the things that softens the heart and to some extent at least releases some of the anger, if not the outrage. You may be fully entitled to your outrage. You may be fully entitled to your outrage. But to live with anger is to live with a high level of inner toxicity. And very few of us can afford this. Very few. So if we just look at this absolutely crucial giant step, it is to release the other person from your desire that they would suffer. That they would suffer appropriately or suffer in the fires of hell for all eternity, however long that actually turns out to be. I'm not quite sure myself. We have a very well-cultivated capacity in the human condition to wish for vengeance, to wish for suffering, to wish for retribution. The first crucial thing in the stages of forgiveness is to withdraw from that situation your desire, your craving, your obsession that the other person would suffer so that they would know how you have suffered. It is a deep desire. It's a very honest desire. And it's an utterly deforming desire. And please believe me, I understand this desire, and it harms you. There's a very big phrase in the Bible that says, "Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord." And many people take this to mean an affirmation of vengeance. I think it's the absolute opposite. I think it's the absolute opposite. It's really understandable why we would think that, because there's so much rhetoric in both the Old and New Testaments and in the Quran that is harmful, that supports harm. So I can understand that. But I think that particular phrase says something else. I think it could possibly say rather, leave it to destiny. Don't wish harm to another, because it will harm you. So, for your own sake, you could experiment with, risk the silver rule, not wishing harm. Even to someone who has grievously harmed you or grievously harmed someone you love. You might never get beyond that. You might never get beyond quenching the desire to exile that person from the human family. You have already achieved so much. You have already separated yourself from that situation. You have already come back into the stream of life. And where does the stream of life flow to? To the great ocean that we all share. And remember that this story of forgiveness is always one where we're playing all the parts. I don't mean that you are complicit in the harm that you have done, but there will be things that you have done that you find so difficult to forgive yourself for. And there will be things you've done to others that they may have difficulty in forgiving you for. I know that's true in my life. And each time we feel a little more freedom, each time we are able to revel in this present moment when that outrage is not happening, each time we are able to drink from the living waters, we experience the grace of forgiveness. It is a grace. It is a grace. It is a grace, 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 because it defies the rational mind. The rational mind tells you you are entitled to it. But it's also the rational mind that can tell you that you are more than entitled to go to battle, literally. We are cursed as a race with literal thinking, are we not? We are. Oh, here's somebody who's written something very long. In your story about the man at your ordination, was there a time when you may have refused to allow him to ordain you for the sake of integrity or something similar? Did you wrestle with that option when you felt distressed and reactive to his rigid position? Was it hard to choose the position of grace and trust the divine outcome? I don't like to think about it, but I wonder now if my stand for integrity at times in my life has in fact been a stand of self-righteousness. What is your opinion about integrity and self-righteousness? What a fantastic question. What an amazing question. And it is, in fact, a very useful question to me. So I hope it's a very useful question to you. And one of the reasons that it's a question of usefulness to me is that I made a little joke earlier about being well-versed in the 60s. And the double meaning of that, not only because I am in my 60s, but because I am a graduate of the 60s. Better still, let me tell you, I went to the best possible university, which was Europe, 1967 onwards. I lived in Berlin from 70 to 71. I was in Paris, you know, when it happened. I was in London when we made it happen. You know, I was very, very privileged. I was also highly conditioned in self-righteousness. And I had a very big appetite for it. And some of it came out of the best possible reasons. My personal humiliations as a woman and my righteousness on behalf of other women who'd been humiliated in ways that I could barely imagine throughout time, humiliated by their families, humiliated by life, humiliated by religious institutions and so on. I was also very engaged in civil rights. Again, I was very righteous and self-righteous on behalf of those who'd not just been humiliated but enslaved. Can we even imagine this? What it means for one person to feel entitled to enslave another? enslave. Not just insist on your agenda, but insist that your agenda serves mine in the most humiliating ways possible. That your integrity counts for nothing, and I am entitled to buy and sell it. Okay, so that's my story. But there was a lot of excitement in it. There was a lot of excitement in seeing the world through different eyes. It was much harder, I think, to learn to see that we are all in it together. And how hard it is to offer compassion and prayer and peacemaking to people whose power disgusts you and harms others. Are they part of the human family or are they not? It's so hard to learn that. It was also hard to learn that I didn't have to put people right. That I didn't have to persuade them of a different point of view. And in seeking the sacred, I give a very tender, very, very moving example of that. Of someone who was raised in a most sincere tradition, who believed most sincerely that she had to offer people the opportunity to bring Jesus into their hearts, and that if she missed this opportunity, she could be condemning them to a lifetime and an eternity of darkness. Just think what a responsibility that is. And this person was innately kind. So we could be inclined to judge the intrusions of a fundamentalist point of view, whether it's political or religious, as nothing but an intrusion, and in fact, a discourtesy and thoroughly unwelcome. Well, it probably is thoroughly unwelcome, but it could come from the highest intention. It could come. I have to say that was a transformative story for me to hear and to share with you. It gave me an understanding of religious fundamentalists that was quite wonderful and disarming. And this word disarming is such a good word. I laid down my arms. I could open my arms more because I could also see myself in it, how uncomfortable I would sometimes feel. And sometimes I do still speak up. Please don't think I don't. If I hear someone expressing a racist view or a really sexist view or really religiously intolerant view, I do, of course, still speak up. I think that's fine to do so. But I no longer feel I have to put that person right, which is a terrible responsibility. It's deeply uncomfortable. And I'm not sure that it's really all that helpful, because often what happens is that the person defends their position and entrenches it. Anyway, All of that took a long time, a few decades. In regard to that particular situation, yes, there would have been a time when I found it much more difficult. There were moments when I thought, how can I go back? But, you know, my calling to this ministry was so clear and so unconditional that I had to go back. And the grace of that moment was that I hadn't expected his personality issues or mine, my personality issues, which were just as big as his, to be so irrelevant. That was the grace of the moment. That was the grace that was completely unbidden and unexpected, because we weren't meeting at the level of ideology. We weren't meeting at the level of the conditioned self. We weren't meeting at the level of opinion. We were meeting at a wholly different place that was entirely holy. And you know, that's one of the beautiful things about coming together in silence. That's one of the wonderful things about meditating together. Our conditioned self, our ideologized, I have no idea, is there such a word? our opinionated self can have a rest. We can have a rest from polishing it up. We can have a rest from defending it. You know, it has its place, but its place is not everywhere. Maybe that's what I've learned. I'm a very slow learner. It's taken me a long time. You know, I have to really thank God that I've lived this long. I really do. I thank God that I've lived this long. I have more to learn. I'd like a few more decades to learn it. So I thank you very, very much for your questions. They were jewels. I hope that they take you back again to thinking, what is a question? What is my question? Whether it is in the bowl or in the bowl of my heart. What is my question? Where am I looking for my answers? Am I looking only into the pages of other people's experience? Or am I also looking into the pages of my own hard-won experience? How am I reading my own life? How am I reading nature and human nature? I think I have a little text here. No, I don't have it with me, but I have a beautiful text in which Hazrat Inayat Khan, whom I've quoted several times, invites us also, and I know this is going to mean something lovely to some of you, to read on a constant basis the nature that we behold outside ourselves as well as within, because there all of life is written. And most explicitly and most appropriately for this day, for this Easter day, what is written in the pages of the world out there is that everything in the manifest form has a beginning. As Plato said, the soul of an oak is in the acorn. Everything has a beginning, and in the manifest form will flower, will wilt, will lose its leaves, will die down, will go into the soil, and will come again. Every day, a new beginning.